stuff too, because I'm interested in all you guys' careers. As you like,
I got what question you're gonna ask, so then I'll tell you what I'll answer them or not, so it gives me an idea.
I'm just gonna ask about obstacles in getting yourself established in the majors, moving from Chicago to Baltimore, influence of Earl Weaver, your career, things like that. And I'm going to ask you about the holdout and boycott in 69. I don't know if you remember much about that. I'm focusing on the player reps when I talk about that, and I know you weren't a player rep, but talked with Rick Wise this morning. He was, and Mo was also. And you ever wish that Nick Pietrasanti had gotten around you that day?
I don't think that had anything to do with the baseball part of it.
Did the knee bother you, though, through the years? Did it work?
Well, I had the operation, and first one in 1960. And I've had four subsequent operations. Survival.
Yeah. Didn't slow you down much, though, because I know speed was your main ticket to the majors, probably, right?
Well, I hope they had the hip to get there and play defense. Speed was just part of it.
Was finding one spot to play on defense a problem for you? Establishing yourself at one position instead of getting moved around a lot?
Well, I don't think it was a difficulty for myself. It was what the organization wanted at that particular time. I played the outfield when I first signed, and they moved me into second base, and then the third base. So actually, it was just the reverse. It was third base and then second base. But I played third base in AAA, and went to Winter Ball, played second base in Winter Ball, and the first year in the majors was at second base.
And then you came full circle, because you ended up in the outfield in the Orioles
basically
after a while.
Basically, I played center and then left field.
Yeah. What was it like playing in Comiskey in the years when it was tailored to the pitchers and the defense? Was that a problem for you?
Well, not for me. I think the way the club was designed and the type of players and the type of coaching that was instrumental there, Al Lopez was more of a play for the big runs and steal once in a while type of game. Under Eddie Stanky was go-go. Two and one ball games, defense was the primary focus of the ball club, pitching and defense. Mm-hmm. And the adaptations of the ballpark for that were made, and we had to adjust.
It was tough, though, wasn't it?
It was tough. They kept the grass a little bit taller, and of course that helped to slow the ball down a little bit for defense. That and sinker ball pitchers, guys mm-hmm. keep the ball down, get a lot of ground balls.
Yeah, talked to Bob Locker.
Yeah,
he was part of that incredible bullpen.
Yeah, Locker was certainly part of it. Like I said, knuckleballer Wolverwood was with it. He was younger at that time. Eddie Fisher.
Mm-hmm. And Hoyt, of course.
Yeah, Cohen was the master.
He was something, wasn't he?
Right.
Yeah, you were there when they had that whole string of years under ERA under two every year. Nobody could touch him, could they?
Yeah, I went up in, 64 through 67. I was with the White Sox there at those years.
Yeah, I've seen your players wandering in and out this afternoon.
Can you hear over there?
No. Mind if I sit down next to you and... Yeah. What did it feel like getting traded? Was it a shock to you or a...
No, at the end of the 67 season, and we had a chance to run a pennant, I guess they had made some changes during mid-season and brought in Boyer and Colabito to play for long ball with the ball club. And at the end of the year, discussions were made and questions were asked to give our opinion and focus on the ball team for the year by Eddie Stanky. And I expressed that I felt
when he changed the club about mid-season and getting Boyer and going for home runs, I think it changed the mold of the ball club. And we were hustle, go, steal bases. Then we started to play, wait for the long ball, and we didn't get it the second half. And at the end of the conversation, at the end of the year, I felt that betrayed him. Just intuition.
As far as I can estimate, playing for Earl Weaver really changed your career, didn't it?
I don't know if it changed my career. I think it. I think Earl saw me play. I played against him in the minor leagues. I think he felt I had some ability, and I think it was just a matter of once he took over, the opportunity of me being there and putting me in the lineup probably enhanced his career because the production that was made at that particular time.
I forget, had you led off with the White Sox, or did he make you lead off?
Lead off in second, mostly lead off.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember much about the holdout and the boycott in the winter of 68-69, Marvin Miller asking the players not to sign their contracts because of the pension
We signed the contracts, and just before the opening of the season in spring training, there was the holdout part of it. I'm not opening the season. And I think we had to disperse from spring training. And once we reported back, guys, we couldn't use the facility of the owners, the club, stadiums, et cetera, for practice. We used to go out to high schools or wherever facility we could get to just to work out. And hit, whatever. But it was a lockout in that sense. They locked it out so that we could use the facility.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was the total initial move to create the organization or the player association the way it is today.
Yeah.
Sticking together.
Yeah, that was the first time that you were asked to. Was it a tough thing? Most guys are anxious to get to spring training, and here Miller was saying
it was a tough decision to make, but I think as players we knew that the outcome of that decision would benefit the players at that particular time. I think the minimum salary was around $8,500 a year or $9,000.
Yeah.
And clubs were sticking to that or saying take it or leave it, that type of situation, and it was time to make a change. And the only way that we could make a change that was very influential was to band together, stick together as collective bargaining.
And it worked.
It worked.
Did you ever imagine that the reserve clause would be undone? It was hard to foresee, wasn't it?
No, it was hard to foresee at that time, and it was also hard to foresee the changes that would be totally made in relationship to today compared to then. Actually, I think the realization that there would be some changes made if we won as one collective bargaining part of it. I think we saw changes. It would be better. And how much better? I mean, you could feel like it would be 100% better. You'd have to feel that all contracts would be probably doubled, because I think the surveys that were made by Marvin Miller and his other wages were just really not competitive to the field.
The figure I've seen is that in 67 or 8, a third of all major leaguers were making $10,000 or less.
Exactly right. And that's, that was certainly unfair. The control by the major league owners at that time were, you didn't take it, it was just see you later, and plus you couldn't go to another ball club or there was no free agency. Your bargaining power was almost nil as a player.
Is it fair to say that if free agency had existed, you would not have gone to Japan? You would have had been able to sign with another team.
Sure,
right?
Sure. In fact, the Orioles statement, I asked to be traded or released. When I did go to Japan in 73, and they refused to do it.
that because they thought you'd just go and come right back and then they'd have you again?
Well, I think if they had given me a release, they thought I may have gone to another club and maybe produced the same way that I had with the Orioles, even though they had a feeling that the age, there was a variance of age there. And I guess the statements were, your age, you made it, and you may not be able to do the things you did in the past. Well, that was only one off year at 5 for the Orioles.
Mm-hmm.
That was very tough for me to take because they wanted to cut my salary at that particular time.
In other words, they didn't think you could do the job for them, but they were afraid you could do the job for somebody else.
Yeah, if they let me go to another club, they felt that it would hurt the Orioles anymore. When I played for the White Sox, I think my lifetime average against the Orioles was over 300.
Probably why they wanted you in the first place.
I think so. It was originally just a player utility role as a backup, a second baseman, third baseman for Brooks. And then when I went over there in 68, the outfield situation was having difficulty hitting because Frank was hurt from hitting his head with
the double vision.
Had a double vision, and the other outfielders, Kurt Belfrey, Blair, both and David May, they weren't hitting real well average-wise. And I was hitting fairly decent, for Hank Bauer, pinch hitting and still playing a little bit. And I had asked Earl to talk to Hank, and because I had played the outfield. And Earl said, no, you talk to him. And I went in and talked to Hank, and he said the players that played for him in 66 were the players that would continue playing for him. And so I was relegated to the same role I had in the beginning. And then Earl took over at the All-Star break and put me in the lineup.
He benched you early in 69. Had a slow start, but once you got back in, you never really looked back, did you?
Well, it was kind of funny. In spring training, we told all the veteran players to just come to camp, be ready to play, just get in shape. And then during the spring training time, Merv Wertman had a good spring, and I was putting effort in to try to get 300 in the spring just to get in the shape because that's what he expressed. And at the outset of the season, he said he was going to start the open lineup, and I wasn't going to be in it. And then I had a little bit of an argument. I said, well, that's how you feel. And I had a big argument with the guardian, and it was going on what he had expressed to me in spring training prior to. And I said, if you had said, whoever wins the job, it's a different story. But that's not what you said. But initially, I opened up the season anyway because he started a right-handed pitcher.
I have to tell you, I was a Mets fan in 69. And when you led off the series with the home run off Seaver, I remember thinking, well, the party's over. Do you guys feel the same?
Oh, I don't know if we thought the party was over. I know that we had a good ball club, and I know we had the talent to possibly win the World Series. It just so happened that in the second game, everything seemed to turn around with a diving catch, I think, but Harrison made on me and shortstop.
Yeah.
And then after that play, everything just seemed to go their way. And I can't, if I could put my finger on how and why, I'd probably be a genius.
They just seemed less with the catches.
Just the way baseball is, and anytime you have two teams in a series like that, any one club can get hot and the right things happen can go your way. I still feel there were some plays that were made. J.C. Martin and on the grass, I think, if you go by the rules, he's out, and that's interference. But diving catch by Soboto with the bases loaded really did call for that type of play because they were leading. If he misses that ball, then we score three runs easy and Brooks is on with a triple. And those are the type of things that you
just... That was an incredible play.
But diving catch wasn't called for in the situation. You never know. It's tough to say what's going to happen in a ball game. guys you expect to hit home runs don't, and guys you don't expect to hit home runs.
Right, Al Weiss.
Al Weiss.
And it seemed like all their long shots got cashed in 1 week.
Right.
But of course, their pitching carry them too.
Yeah. I guess the pitching part, we know most of the pitchers except for Gentry. We weren't sure on Gentry. We didn't know much about him. And he threw harder than we thought he threw, and had better stuff than we thought he had. To me, it was one of the factors.
Well, they're all factors, but
yeah, it was a surprise factor for them.
And you had an early look at Nolan Ryan.
Yeah, we knew too. Nolan Ryan. We knew Seavers, we knew Ryan, we knew Kuzma. Gentry was a surprise one.
I wanted to ask you about the that weird brawl in Chicago in 71 where the fans jumped you from the stands.
Yeah,
what was that all about? I mean,
it was all about me hitting home runs.
You hit two and got dusted.
I hit one off of Orland, and then when Johnson came in, I hit one off of him, the one in the upper deck, and the next time up, he went behind my head. And baseball knowledge, and the approach of any major league player, the guy throws behind your head, and he has an intent to hurt you. And that's what I felt. If you throw inside under my chin, or brush me back, I would never say anything. I got hit many a time and didn't mind getting hit, because I thought that was the respect of the opposing pitcher in the club. And I enjoyed that, because I know I'd get on base and steal the base and put more pressure on. But when he threw it behind my head, at head level, where you have the peripheral vision doesn't tell you which direction to go, that's intent to hurt. And I will always feel that way. So that's why I went to the mound and caught him between third and the mound and told him, if you throw up my head again, my career may end, but yours will end too. And that was the context of that short conversation. We didn't fight or anything like that. I just wanted to make sure he understood that. Later on in the game, fans were putting rocks and cups and throwing rocks and hitting him in the back and on deck circle, and a fan broke a chair back on the outfield. A wooden chair back stuck as I was bent over waiting for a pitch to be thrown to the plate and stuck 3 feet in front of my head.
Wow.
And from the upper deck it came. And the fan later on in the game jumped down off of their dugout side, the third base side, and come charging toward me in the on deck circle. That's where all the trouble happened to me. At the ball club at that time.
That's the photo that I've seen. Yeah, it was in the Sporting News, I guess.
And then the fan came out at the end of the game and said all the action was going on, and he had been drinking beer and he wanted to get in on the action. I was kicked out of the game, but I had said to the umpire, I said, all you have to do is say any more degree and stuff thrown before that game, and they wouldn't do it, and they kicked me out of the game.
I hadn't heard the part about the chair in the outfield.
Yeah,
wow.
The chair back came from the upper deck and just landed right in front of me.
You know, Bertie Tebbets one time got hit by a tomato crate from the upper deck. And Cleveland,
that's
plywood,
thin wood.
Yeah, it knocked him out.
Yeah, from that distance.
Knocked him forward, yeah.
That chair back hit me in the head, I'm dead.
Yeah.
Coming from the upper deck.
Welcome back to Comiskey, huh?
Well,
could have happened anywhere, though, right?
Well, yes, it could have. I mean, you never like to think that fans are unappreciative enough of understanding the game of baseball that they want to hurt players for no reason whatsoever, especially when you're not dealing with game and sport. Everyone has a desire to win and play hard.
Is the DH causing more players to charge the mound now because they can't retaliate against the pitcher? Is that?
I would imagine that has something to do with it. I think there's other ways that you can also retaliate if it's a situation. They have to cover first base on bunts. They have to cover first on double play situations. There are ways to retaliate other than charging them out.
It seems like there's more of it, though, doesn't there?
Over a period of years, I think so. I think a lot of players have a tendency, because of the double flap helmets, they have a tendency to stay in longer, and they'll take pitches up, or some guys just throw their arms up. A lot of the players, in my mind, of what I've seen, don't know how to get out of the way of the ball. Certainly the guys throwing 85 or 90 miles an hour, I'm not going to take one on the arm or in the head. It doesn't make sense. If you can get out of the way, why not get out of the way? I see a lot of players just turning and taking those pitches for whatever reason.
Yeah, right.
I didn't like to get hit in the head.
Is that something you can teach the young players?
It's a reaction, and I think yes. And I think if the ball comes up and in, you should automatically do it on your own. Maybe you don't want to hit the ground. Maybe you think that's not macho, but you get out of the way. That's a key.
Of course, you saw Paul Blair get being real good.
That was a fastball that was up and in, and it just ran. Just one of those.
Did he freeze on that?
Yeah. Frozen.
It really affected his career.
He came back, but it did affect his career.
Pete Ward, too, right?
I guess. I didn't see Pete as much as I saw Paul after he got there, because they were on different ball paths. But, sometimes you do freeze, and you just. It's hard to explain. A guy who throws a fastball, maybe if it's straight, you get out of the way, but if it's a running fastball, it's tough. You don't know. That's why I say you always try to get out of the way on every pitch as best you can. You don't take a chance.
Yeah. Well, I should let you go.
Okay. Hope I answered a little bit for you.
Yeah,